The Airplane Geeks podcast is proudly sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn-to-fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 217 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I have some co-hosts with me. First, we have David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hey, folks. Thanks for listening, and welcome to a very pleasant day in Philadelphia. We haven't had any events at the airport in a whole week, which is good news, and the weather's been fall-like, so it looks like we're well on our way to the end of the year, and God forbid 2013. So,
our other usual co-host, Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog, is off again this week, but he did send in a little message for us. Here's Rob.
Hi, this is Rob Mark. And for those of you that were wondering where I was last week, thanks to Max and David, who completely forgot to mention that I was trapped inside the cabin of a Southwest Airlines jet at 35,000 feet coming back home, I want to apologize. And unfortunately, I'm not here tonight either. Well, I won't give you a good excuse. Let's just say it was very important. But I will be back next week, although I won't be in Chicago. I'll be calling in from on the road in the aviation capital of the world, beautiful Wichita, Kansas, where I'll be in town to attend the annual Bombardier Safety Standout. Of course, one thing does bother me about missing two shows. No one seems to even notice that I was gone. Guys, should I be worried about my job?
Now, we also have kind of a special co-host with us tonight. And you may recognize his name because he's a pretty active member of our listener community, and that's John Arvin. John, thanks for joining us.
Hey, everybody. Thanks a lot, Max. Hello from sunny Phoenix, Arizona, where the sun's still up. Oh. I think the temperature's finally below 100 degrees, and it's starting to come into the sweet spot out here in the desert.
Beautiful. Now, John's a first officer at an airline. Can we say the name of the airline, John?
Yeah, I think so. As long as I mention that my thoughts are my own and not those of my employer.
John flies for Southwest Airlines.
Yes, that's correct.
Let me guess, John, you fly 737.
I fly one of the 630 737s that we have out there.
Well, that's great. And John, we're really happy to have you joining us. And I think for some of the topics we're going to talk about this episode, you'll be able to provide some interesting perspective, a pilot's perspective. So we welcome that.
It'll be my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, our guest this episode is Nigel Howarth from Aviation Week. He's a senior fleet analyst, and he also does MRO forecasting. Nigel, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm currently sat in a hotel at Washington Dulles Airport. It's a lovely, fine evening, although I've got no idea how cold it is out there. But whatever it is, it's an awful lot warmer than it is back home in Britain. So glad to be here.
Now, we wanted to thank you also for joining us on such short notice. We did have another guest scheduled, but was unable to make it, and Nigel was kind enough to step in. So we're really pleased to have Nigel with us, and I think we can talk about some aspects, some things that we haven't touched on in the podcast before. So we're looking forward to that. But before we pick Nigel's brain, we're going to talk about a few aviation stories, news stories from the past week, and we have David's This Week in Aviation History segment, and that featuring the aircraft of the week. So, David, what have we got this time?
A airplane designed by an American-born British citizen that became a knight and was the fastest man alive in two different modes of transportation. The Blackburn B-1 Seagrave 30s vintage aircraft. It's a little bit of an interesting story. There's more, a little bit more man than airplane in this story, but it's a good one.
All right. Look forward to that. And, of course, we also have Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast with their Australia desk report. And our European contributor, Peter Johnson, has his Across the Pond segment. And then we've also got a little bit of listener mail to finish up the show. All right, if everyone's ready, we'll get started with some aviation news. Our first story is an item that we've been covering, seems like every week. This is from the LA Times. Accusations fly between American Airlines pilots. No talks on tap. Well, the American Airlines labor dispute continues. It's complicating the business of running an airline in the midst of bankruptcy. The airline accuses the pilots of calling in sick and submitting large numbers of maintenance orders. We talked about that last week. And the union says there is no work slowdown. According to the article, it seemed that there was the possibility of a return to the table, but then American sent a letter to the union threatening a legal injunction if the perceived work slowdown wasn't discontinued. There's an interesting quote in the article. It says, on Thursday of this being last week, the on-time arrival rate for the carrier's flights was 53%. Far below its historical rate of nearly 80%. So clearly there's an effect on the operations of this airline as a result of this. John, maybe you can kind of weigh in a little bit with the airline pilot's perspective. Is this kind of behavior unexpected in this case?
It seems like whenever you get into a case like this and you've got contract negotiations and the third variable would be the judgment from the court side. But when you see drastic numbers, I think, and I missed the discussion that you guys had from the last show, but I think when you see sick rates, I don't think that their sick rates were unusually high. Maintenance-wise, that's always a case of, you know, people finding, there's always going to be something that you can find on the airplane. If that's really what you get down to. But on the labor side, it seems like they're at a real impasse between what the company wants to do with their future payments and goals and what the pilots think that they're basically entitled to from what they signed. So it seems like a real difficult proposition between the two. And I'm just kind of wondering how they find some kind of common ground.
Right. Where is that common ground?
That's easy. You just have a bunch of refs screw up really badly and suddenly everybody comes to the table.
Yeah. You need maybe some kind of forcing function.
Hey, Max, should we talk about the airplanes that have the seats left the floors over the last 2 days?
Were those on American?
Yeah, they were.
I thought that's where you were going with the story, Max. I thought that was the whole thing of it.
Yeah, there was a seat issue lately. What? Some seats came loose or something like that on, maybe two of the flights?
Well, I just heard it was one flight, and it diverted from Boston to JFK, and it was, I think it was a 757 of American, and the row of seats became totally detached, so it was kind of floating.
Wow. Yeah, they said it had broken runners down the floor. It had just a brand new interior that they put into it, and the seats came dislodged on rows 12, D, E, and F. Literally, they had to take the people out of the seats because the seats were like flying around the cabin.
Oh, wow. There, no injuries, I hope.
No injuries, but not only did it happen once, but it happened twice. American is really, you know, when it rains, it pours. You know, it always seems to be when you're really down in the dumps, even more stuff happens, or more to the point, the press pay attention more.
Is the supposition that the seats came loose because of maybe a faulty installation in the in the interior, or I mean, no one's saying this is sabotage.
No one's
right?
saying no. Okay. They're saying it was a faulty installation. They're not saying that the pilots are running back and unscrewing the bolts from the seats, but it's just another one of those incidents where you wonder if American Airlines could ever really recover from this, because now it's just one more thing that passengers are going to have in their mind when they book a flight. Maybe if they have a choice between American Airlines and some other airline, they're going to go with the other airline, which isn't going to help the bankruptcy process.
Yeah, this could kind of be a death spiral in some ways. I mean, if this gets completely out of hand, I mean, this is the sort of situation that really, you know, as John mentioned before, sort of begs for something to, you know, bring the parties together. But I guess that would be in a way that they haven't come together in the past. I mean, they've never really had a great relationship with the pilots and the company.
I personally see that the airline's goal is to get their costs as low as possible. And of course, those pilots have been around for a long time. They're an older pilot group, so their pay levels are probably close to max, you know, to the max limit. When you look at these growth airlines like Allegiant or Spirit, they're growing so quickly that their pay scales are lower, and their pilots are still coming up in the pay scale. American wants to lower theirs to be competitive with that kind of a cost structure. And I think when you guys talk about will it be detrimental for the future of the airline, I think that the traveling public's memories are so short. It basically depends on, you know, what's the cheapest fare other than, say, your business traveler. But when it comes to, like, Spirit, you look at Spirit where they say any kind of advertising is good advertising as long as somebody's saying the name of the airline. They have such a bad reputation, but they still are continuing to grow. They're adding segments and airplanes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, yeah, about the short memory span of the flying public. I think you're probably right, John.
Witness Ryanair.
Yeah, Nigel.
If anything exemplifies the short memory of the flying public, it has to be Ryanair. The things that the O'Leary says are just outrageous, and yet, you know, they just never stop growing.
That's true. And, you know, we talk about him a lot, and I think all the time we see these stories come through and we, you know, say to ourselves, he's just trying to get publicity. But, you know, they're so outlandish that we can't help ourselves. We have to talk about them, and there goes the publicity.
And single pilot.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Pay restrooms and everything. So
standing passengers.
That's right. That's another good one. Standing passengers. Well,
that's just unbelievable.
I know. It's hard to imagine.
His latest rant, I don't know if it made the news here. It was like about 2 weeks ago. A family from the UK were in Spain, and they said that they couldn't get to a computer while they were away, so they turned up without boarding passes.
Yes.
Did you see that?
Yeah, we did talk about that one, and he basically, I mean, O'Leary was awfully rude to this.
Well, you couldn't even broadcast it, you know, offline. He called them a bunch of fucking morons and idiots.
Yes.
You can't broadcast what he calls them, but basically he said 0.02% of their passengers are idiots, and they turn up without boarding passes.
Yeah,
and they get what they deserve, and they had to pay like £260, $400.
It's outrageous. It really is. But he's quite a character.
Yeah, but I don't think he does it just for publicity. I think he generally is a nasty piece of work.
Oh, yeah? Is that the sort of the general impression in you know, in Europe and of O'Leary?
I don't think many people actually outside of the industry actually know who he is, because he's not like he's on the TV much or anything. He makes the aviation press obviously regularly, and the news when he says things like that.
Sure.
But the perception of Ryanair in general is that they're horrible, nasty, avoid at all costs, but everyone goes on them because they're so cheap.
Yeah, it does seem to work. They're still in business and seemingly doing well.
You know, he could call anybody anything, and they'd still fly with him anyway.
I think you're right. All right. Well, why don't we move from one airline CEO to another, talk about United Airlines. Our next story comes from Boston.com. United Airlines CEO Smizik talks 787s and Mojo. And this is interesting. United Continental Holdings picked up their shiny new Boeing 787, which, interestingly enough, according to the article, was a plane that was ordered 7 years ago. And this is the first of a 50-aircraft fleet. Smizik says he talks about improved passenger comfort and fuel efficiency as being the big draw for that plane. John, I don't think we're going to see any 787s in the Southwest fleet anytime soon.
Well, I heard a rumor that there's an unnamed buyer that has 80 in a block that are Ooh. Set to be delivered. So I was kind of hoping that that was Southwest, but no, I don't see those in our future.
No.
Working on the 737-800 right now.
Sure. These fleet planning lead times can be awfully long. When you look at analyzing fleets, are you forecasting out into the future, or are you collecting and determining the current fleet?
Oh, very much into the future. Yeah, I mean when somebody comes in like United with that 50 order, which I just looked it up and it was 30th of the June 2005.
Hmm.
Because you wanted to know that, of course. you get a press release that say they've ordered 50 and started delivering in 2008, which is probably what they were hoping for. And sometimes they'll tell you the end date, sometimes they won't. And we have to kind of apportion those 50 aircraft over so many months and years. But as time goes on and the program slips, we have to continually revise those delivery schedules. So for every single aircraft on order, whether it be jet, turbo, or whatever, yeah, we're continually predicting the future, if you like. Mm. So for every year going forward, we can say there's that many on order and that many on order. And then even more so, we're more into the realms of the unknown. We have to predict orders that have not even been placed yet.
Ah, yes.
Because, you know, as of things today, there may be only 150 737s on order that are firm orders with a delivery date of, say, 2018. But we know that in 2018 that they're going to be building way over 400. Hmm. So we have to try and guess where those other 300 are going and do some predictions on that. Obviously not to which carriers, but at least to which regions. Or
right.
So, yeah. So it's a constantly evolving portfolio, if you like.
Sure. Do you ever look backward and assess how accurate your predictions were, or is this kind of always rolling forward?
We do look backward in some respect. We don't look at last year's prediction and say, oh, how close it was, or because we do these things on an annual basis because they take so long to do. You can't really do these forecasts like every month or every quarter or anything. But we don't look back and say, oh, well, last year's was way off, or you know, it was close, because people don't really want to know how last year's stacked up. They only want to know what's the future, which is why they buy the things in the first place. But what we do look back for is we look back to see the trends. So we can say, like, you know, look back 3 or 4 years, how have CRJs been retiring, or how have 767 orders been placed? And then we use that to predict the future. So yeah, we look back at orders and deliveries, but not to see what last year's forecast said.
Hmm. Okay, yeah, interesting. I've got some more questions about that, but I don't want to stray too far from the news before we move on. So, in fact, okay. let's do that. Let's look at our third story. This is from The Telegraph. We need drone aircraft, says police chief. Now, this article describes that the National Police Air Service, the NPAS, is launching in England, and the senior officer, or a senior officer from the Hampshire Police, Alex Marshall, said that drones will cost less than manned aircraft and can stay in the air longer. And he also notes that the CAA, the Civil Aviation Authority, doesn't allow the use of drones currently out of line of sight. and there are other restrictions on them, and it also raises the privacy issue, or privacy for our European listeners. If you look at the news, you almost can't look at the aviation news without seeing some kind of UAV or drone item coming up. And, you know, I can just imagine that, you know, folks like police agencies, law enforcement, that sort of thing, as well as others, you know, services, fire and so forth, could make tremendous use of drones of various sorts. But, you know, one thing, maybe since we have John Arvin with us, one thing that comes up is discussions about unmanned aircraft in the national airspace. And our friend Rob, of course, is always has a very strong opinion about that. John, have you, you know, given much thought to the future where there are drones flying around in the same airspace as your 737?
I guess I have a feeling that eventually, at some point, it will happen. Just because when you talk about like national defense and things like that, it just seems like those are really pushing towards the future of the Air Force presence. When you look at military side, and of course, David would have a better handle on that. It just seems like we really push more and more in that direction. So I can't see how we could hold them off forever. I think they'll probably be in the airspace. They'll probably be a lot safer than a lot of NORDO aircraft that we have flying around, where guys are off frequency or missed a handoff, and you know, things happen up in airspace, and they have a way of moving us around to keep everything where it's supposed to be. So that's not too big of a factor. And then the other thing I think of when I just recently watched that movie Act of Valor.
Hmm.
They have a little drone that they throw by hand, and it has a camera on it, and it helps those guys kind of see an aerial view of this area that they're going in to take down some people. And that's what I think of. When I think of like a police drone, I'm thinking of something that they're going to throw up maybe a couple of hundred feet in the air, and it's going to have a little bit of a video presence, and it'll be able to help them kind of navigate streets, where people are, or cars, maybe take the place of like a police helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
So I could see that happening too.
Actually, it's kind of funny. Back in the day when I had a friend who built a very large-scale Harrier, but the Harrier was painted in Pennsylvania State Police markings.
Oh, really?
With the title underneath it of the diorama as "Speed Enforced by Aircraft," with a bunch of little car kill marks underneath the cockpit. It's not so far advanced that you have a predator prowling the turnpike and you start gunning it down the highway, and they just take a couple of photographs of you and send you the ticket later.
Hmm.
No, I don't think we're that far away from that.
Yeah, maybe not. Nigel, do you think are unmanned vehicles, aerial vehicles, becoming, are they on a trajectory so that someday you'll be forecasting the fleet of those as well?
I really don't know whether we're going to be forecasting the fleet of them. So far, nobody's come to us and said, you know, you're not doing UAVs and why not? I think it could happen because the demarcation line between a plane and a UAV seems to be getting smaller and more blurred, and they do seem to be almost a plane without a pilot and not much difference between them. So I think the time may be coming. I can't ever see a time of a UAV taking passengers. I really can't. If they can get the go ahead from the CAA to use those drones, I think it's a great idea, because we're always seeing in the newspapers about the exorbitant prices of the helicopters that the police have. I mean, most of the police forces now, the police forces in the UK are kind of broken up typically into counties. You know, each county has its own helicopter, or if it's a small county, it'll share one with a neighbouring county. But they generally have one helicopter per county, apart from London, which has about three.
Mm-hmm.
And they're usually quoted at something like $3,000 an hour to fly these things.
Yeah, it's very high.
It is. And so, I mean, a drone, you know, it must be a fraction of that, probably less than a tenth or even lower. So like I say, it didn't get the go ahead from the CAA. I mean, I'm all for it because they could get so much more use out of this because so many missions are not taking place because the price is a prohibitor.
Ah, yes, good point. So with the lower price, the lower cost, rather, of conducting missions, you know, this way, it does more than just lower the cost to the, you know, to the police or whoever the agency is. But yeah, it allows them to conduct more missions that presumably have more value.
Absolutely, but the apart from, I think you said it was the CAA don't allow drones out of sight. That the problem I foresee is the public have got such an obsession with privacy that if they even get wind that there's a drone up there looking at them and there's nobody, you know, inside it, they don't seem to have a problem with police helicopters because they know they're out there chasing the bad guys. But if they think there's a drone up there, they're just going to think they're being spied on. And I think that's going to be probably a bigger hurdle than getting permission from the CAA. That's just my own feeling on it. But
again, we're with Nigel Howarth from Aviation Week, and we want to talk. We've been talking a little bit about fleet analysis, and want to talk about MRO forecasting. But Nigel, let me ask you this: who are the customers of the fleet analysis that you do? Who's looking for that information?
Really, I would say, well, there's a broad range of customers, but I think the two main ones, the MRO companies themselves, you know, the people like Delta TechOps, Lufthansa Technik. I'm not saying those people exactly are customers, but those kind of people.
Right.
So the MRO, the MRO providers, as we call them. And the other side tends to be the financial analysts. So, you know, they're looking at they're looking more at the fleet side of the thing than the MRO thing. So they want to see where fleet growth is going to occur in the world and where spend is going to be spent. And they're not really concerned about which MRO provider is going to receive the money. Mm-hmm. But they just want to see the effect of the regional trends. But the MRO providers are obviously very keen to know where there's going to be surges and where there's going to be dips in terms of, like, if you're an MRO provider and you only specialize in CRJs, you want to know where how many CRJs are going to be around in 8 years' time. Because if you look at the forecast and see, oh, actually, by that time, half the fleet's gone out of business, been withdrawn, or they've all been moved out of the North America, and now they're all gone to, like, you know, the kind of second-tier airlines who, suddenly, you need to plan to get out of that CRJ market.
Sure.
And expand yourself maybe into turboprops or upscale to some of the bigger jets. So, you know, they want to see what's coming so they can plan ahead so that they can get the certification to do the right types or even just plan manpower that, you know, in 5 years' time, the amount of A320s on the planet might double. I'm not saying that's the exact figure, but if there's going to be such a huge increase in fleets in the next 5 to 10 years, they need to start putting things in place that they've got not only hangar capacity but manpower capacity to cope with it, because they're going to get a slice of the pie, and you know, that kind of thing. So,
yeah, I can relate to that as an engine guy. I mean, I think back to the, you know, the glory days, I'll call it, of the JT8D engine. And, you know, thousands and thousands of them out there flying all the time. And then the world changed. Oil prices changed. We had other, you know, world events change. And, you know, suddenly you've got 727s parked everywhere and, you know, usage going way down. And it had a, you know, huge effect on the market. So I imagine when there's big world events like that have long-term effects, that must cause you to have to kind of scramble and sort of reforecast, redraw the picture?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that sticks in my mind most about what I did last year, I've been doing this about 3 years now, and we're just about to release our fourth in the next couple of months. The thing that I remember most was the regional jets retirements of, because when we looked at those last year, we've seen a big spike in regional jet retirements, and it's, you know, it's very much correlated to the price of oil. Since the price of oil's gone up, I don't know what the percentage increase is, but regional jets have suffered big time. I mean,
yep.
You know, the Embraer 145 has got practically, well, it has got zero orders except for military and VIP, and the CRJ has got practically none now. It's got a handful of the 1000s, but where the turboprops have gone, you know, strength to strength. Well, ATR have, not so much Bombardier, but worse than not having the orders, the CRJs and are beginning to retire in large numbers, and will continue to do so over the next few years, just because the economics of operating those, you know, those smaller jets are not what they were 10, 15 years ago when the CRJs were, you know, you couldn't make them fast enough.
Right.
And that's down to the, you know, what you call as the world event of the increasing price of oil. So yeah, that's one thing.
Hey Nigel.
Yeah.
How does it look for those? Yeah, it's John. How does it look for the, like, the 190s and the 175s and maybe that C series when you talk about those classes?
The 170s, 195s, we've forecasted them pretty much steady over the next 7 or 8 years to what they are now. There's still a market because there's people, you know, just are not quite big enough for a 737 or an A320. So, but the, you know, they're too big for the turboprops. And at the moment, because the turboprops are not going above 70 seats, if you're talking anything above that, really, you're into that Embraer market. And they've almost got it to themselves at the moment, until C series comes in. If C series comes along and doesn't get canned before it ever gets to service, then I think it'll have a decent future. But I don't think either of them will ever come anywhere close to, you know, to the 737 or the A320. I think where Embraer is at now is probably as good as it'll get for the 170s, 190s.
So this is interesting. To what degree or what level of granularity do you go down? So, for example, you know, do you look at market share of competing aircraft? So I'm thinking of like the A320neo family and the 737 MAX. Do you sort of assign a market share to each and try to forecast them independently, or do you just combine them and say that, no, what we're forecasting is, you know, this many for this size class aircraft?
No, absolutely. We go down to individual aircraft level. So for, like, you know, like the current year and the next few years, we hopefully know where every single aircraft that's coming off the line is going, to which operator and where that operator is. Further out, things like the MAX and the NEO, whilst we have the well-known firm orders, we also know there's going to be a lot more built than what's already been ordered. And so for those, we'll try and forecast just which regions they'll go into. Mm-hmm. But we don't do it on a share basis. We don't think, oh, the MAX will take 40 and the NEO will take 45 and the C series will take 5 or anything like that. We do them on an individual basis. We'll just say that, well, we're expecting in 2018 there's going to be 400 MAXs built, and then we'll say, well, where are those 400 going?
Yeah.
So we won't say there's an overall market of 1,000 and the MAX is getting 40%. We actually do it from the other way. You know, we'll actually look at each aircraft in turn and say, how many do we think are going to be built, based on either what the manufacturer's saying or what we realistically think, because it's not always the same thing.
Okay.
It tends to be the same thing for Boeing and Airbus, because when they say we're going to build, you know, 500 A320 families this year, then you believe them, because pretty good at doing those kind of things. But when the Chinese say we're going to build, you know, 250 COMAC 919s in 3 years, we say, no, you're not. You're probably going to sell about 12 or something, you know.
Right, you have to factor that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wouldn't say you take it with a pinch of salt, but we have to be realistic about these things. And so we do, but every aircraft ordered, or even those not ordered, we do it down on an individual level.
Okay. Let's talk MRO a little bit. That's pretty interesting. Some years ago, I worked in an engine overhaul shop, and so I know the MRO side of the business a little bit. And I guess I would characterize that for our listeners that aren't aware of it as, I mean, you've got airframe MRO, you've got engine MRO, you've got shops that do sort of the disassembly and inspection and sometimes the repairs, and then you have a whole sort of universe of repair shops that tend to specialize in certain kinds of repairs, certain components or that sort of thing. Nigel, I think that's an enormously complex and difficult thing to forecast.
For us idiot historians, what's MRO mean?
Oh, sorry.
It means maintenance, repair, and overhaul.
Thank you.
That's good.
I was going to say that, actually, Max. I did think that some people won't know what that means.
So they do now. So, okay. So the complexity of that, boy, that's tough.
It is. And the first time I did it was about 3 years ago, and I just could not believe the complexity that went into producing the forecast. It's not purely me, but I'm involved in, shall we say, three distinct forecasts. We do a helicopter, a worldwide helicopter forecast. We do a military aircraft, and we do a commercial one, commercial airliners, that is, jets and turbos. And the commercial one in particular is the most in-depth. I mean, there are so many variables. I could just name a few off the top of my head. Obviously, the major driver of them is the hours and cycles and simply calendar months. Then you consider each engine. They have their own intervals that they need to be maintained. Each landing gear has a different interval. Then we look at line maintenance, where there's daily checks, there's weekly checks. There are checks that are done when aircraft are away overnight. So we look at the schedules to see when the wire bodies are away overnight and how many times per year each individual aircraft is away from its home because it gets checked away. Right. And then we look at labor rates. If you have your aircraft maintained in the USA, the labor rate is more than it is in the Far East. And if it's in Europe, each hour costs more than it is in the USA. And if your aircraft maintained away from home, the rate's higher. And in fact, I'm only just scratching the surface, but there are so many variables. We even look at things like there are aircraft that are operated in what we call like desert countries like Saudi Arabia, yep. Yemen, Ethiopia. They incur maintenance faster than those in non-desert because of the rough environment that they're operating in. Their engines suck in a lot of sand, so they incur what we call shop visits. Each time they have to be taken off and go and inspected, they occur faster. And then we look at retirements and try and forecast the retirements based on the ages of the aircraft and also, what I alluded to before, recent historical trends of retirements. So a couple of years ago, the retirements of RJs was very, very low, but now it's much higher. And then we look at modifications, so reconfiguration of seats, new IFEs put in, paint jobs periodically, but not if they're leasing companies. And we look at aircraft that are in store and when they're going to come back from store. Some come out of the desert, some don't. We look at passenger to freighter conversions, and I have to look individually at each aircraft that's a potential freighter conversion and pick them out and say, yeah, that one's probably going to get converted, and when and where it will end up. The variables are endless. All right, they're not endless, but there are so many of them.
They're almost endless.
I don't think I've even done the half of it. And it takes months and months and months of work and kind of to-ing and fro-ing between the team that's doing it with me to say, what do you think of this? And I think that's too high. I think that's too low. And in the end, you know, you've got almost like a work of art based on an awful lot of science. And really no one can say how close it is to the truth because, you know, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, you never really
know. 10 years' time, never mind next year. But hopefully, you know, we come up with something that's close to true. But we actually, for the commercial forecast that Aviation Week do, we have five distinct areas that we forecast. We forecast heavy maintenance, so kind of like C&D checks, as they're generally known as, engine maintenance, line maintenance, modifications, and I forgot the last one. Sorry, you'll have to edit that one out. I'll say we have four main areas. Oh, sorry. No, you can put that back in. Actually, the fifth area is components.
Components,
and within components, there are like 40 different components, and we have to say what each one costs and what each aircraft is going to spend on each component each year, and for the next 10. And when you look at the sums involved, it's like, well, you know, who wants to know this? But and why would anybody bother? But when you look at the sums involved. I've just pulled up the you know, a bit of a summary, and just one part of all that, which is the heavy maintenance part.
Right.
I'm not saying that's the most expensive, but because, you know, if you think about it, the aircraft only go into those C checks typically, say, every year for the heavy users, and maybe every 4 or 5 years for a D check. So it's not stuff that's going on all, you know, every day or every week. And many planes will only hit maybe 3 or 4 D checks in their life before they retire. Some of the other stuff like line maintenance and components adds up to significant numbers. But just on heavy maintenance, and bear in mind we're only looking at westernized types, if you like. You know, we're not trying to forecast sure. What happens in Russia because that's well, let's not even go there.
Yeah, that'd be crazy.
We're talking like Western types, and just on jets for the next 10 years, we're talking 55 billion in C&D checks.
Yeah, this is where the revenue is in the industry.
Yeah, and if you're like thinking, I want to get in the MRO business, and we do C checks, but I think we want to do D checks as well. If you can just get 0.1% of that pie. You know, you're talking major books.
Yes.
So, and then, you know, all the other bits, the line maintenance, the modifications, the components, and the engine spend are equally in the tens of billions. So, and that's just commercial. You know, the military market is even more vast. I think the military market over the next 10 years on just airframe maintenance spend is something over $100 billion.
Yeah,
it's vast. It's vast.
And the interesting one of the interesting things is that when you see in the press aircraft sales in some quote for list price, that's hardly ever the price that's actually paid. The actual price is some small fraction of that usually. But when you listen to these numbers that Nigel's talking about, those are the real numbers. That's like I say, that's where the industry gets its most of its revenue from and most of its profit.
Absolutely. I mean, I've never analyzed it down to like over the life of one plane what it's going to incur in maintenance costs. But I wouldn't be surprised if it exceeds the initial purchase cost.
Oh yeah, I have no doubt either. Yeah.
So yeah, those customers, they say, oh, we got a great deal, but if they told people how much they're going to spend on maintenance, I think the shareholders would be somewhat horrified.
Well, yeah, it's the total price, and when you're looking at running an airline or a business that uses aircraft, it's not just the acquisition cost; it's the total long-term price. Nigel, let me ask you one more thing as we draw to a close on this segment. And this is something that we ask a lot of our guests because we have actually quite a number of our regular listeners are younger folks who kind of aspire to a job in the aviation industry. For those who may be listening that are kind of intrigued by the kind of work that you do, do you have any advice for them what they should focus on or what they should be looking for in school, or any kind of advice like that that might prepare them to, well, to do your job?
I honestly don't think there's anything you can do in school, because I you know, when we've, in companies I've worked for over the past few years, when we've had, you know, bright young things come out of university or whatever, and they've got degrees in business and they've got degrees in economics. If you're not an aviation buff, geek, whatever you call it, by heart, and you know, it's just, if it's not in your blood and you don't just know so much, then I don't even see how you can do the job. You've got to just be passionate about the subject matter, and what you do at school and college will really, I don't think, make any difference whatsoever. I've been, you know, I've been obsessed, if you like, by aircraft since I was about 13. And so what I know is got absolutely nothing to do with what my education told me. What I know is come about from just being there, listening to people, reading the magazines before the internet came along. Certainly is a big thing, because you learn an awful lot out of those. But obviously these days, as you can learn even more from what you can read online. But no, I don't think I can't offer any advice to people about how school is going to help them. Really can't.
Just follow your passion.
Yeah, although I would say, if you can learn something about IT and computers, and you know, learn how to be very skilled, or at least reasonably skilled, at using databases and spreadsheets, then you know, that will give you a bit of a head start, because everybody in our industry is using those, and the ones who can do it well are the ones that are in demand to do my kind of work. And yeah, that's about all I can say on that point.
Right. No, that's great. That's fantastic advice.
That was great, Nigel. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much, Nigel, for joining us. Do you have any online presence, if folks are interested in following you? Or are you on Twitter or anything like that?
I'm afraid I don't do social media.
Okay. That's not a bad thing.
I like talking to people, like on the phone or on calls like this, and I just don't do social media, apart from which after a day at work, my time is with my family, and I just don't do social media.
Okay.
So, no.
Not,
I mean,
problem.
Until recently, you could have looked online and seen the several thousand digital photos I have online, but they've all been pulled down by my ISP. So at the moment, no, I've got pretty much no web presence at the moment.
Okay. Well, I'd love if that changed sometime, and you could at least get some of your photographic work back up. That would be great.
About the only thing you can see on that is, like, in the, you know, in Aviation Week that comes out each week, there's quite often some photographs of mine with credited to me. But that's about the only presence I have at the moment.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll have to look through my the next issue in my subscription, and I'll watch for your photos, Nigel.
Thanks.
All right, again, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Been a fascinating conversation, Nigel.
Well, thanks for asking me. Yeah, it's been fun.
And thanks again for coming on such short notice. And have a safe trip back home.
Cheers. Thank you.
Well, before we go on with David's history segment, John, since we've got you here, maybe we could just spend a couple of minutes talking about your background. Now, you were a corporate pilot for, I think, quite a while before becoming an airline pilot, right?
Yeah, I was a corporate flight department manager for 14 years. I was with a bank software company, and our fleet changed over 14 years. It started out as King Airs and Beach Jets. And it grew into, at the heyday of the flight department, it was six Citations and 14 pilots.
Back in those days, did you aspire to be an airline pilot? Is that something that you wanted to go to, or were you enjoying what you were doing as a corporate pilot?
Yeah, I always kind of laugh. When you sit down with another pilot here at the airline, you kind of feel each other out, and you try and figure out what the other person's background is and where they come from, what their interests are. I always kind of smile because I never dreamed of being an airline pilot, I guess you'd say. I worked the line at the downtown airport after and during college, and I always fueled corporate jets. So I always talked to corporate pilots. I always saw the newest and the latest, greatest, and all the different corporate jets that are out there. And I guess that caught my fancy. I just never really was around airlines. There wasn't flying in my family. My grandfather was a World War II navigator on a B-17 and a B-25.
Oh, wow.
And he was the one that got my aviation interest peaked. And from there, it just kind of grew into whatever I could get my hands on, and that was corporate aviation. So the airline, I think what the airline provided me was an opportunity for long-term career and minimal, I guess I'm fairly conservative, minimal surprises. Mm-hmm. And it's just something that it was a known factor. And the corporate department that I left now, they're down to 4 airplanes. I think they primarily use 3. And so the department's kind of shrunk down. And I just wasn't for sure of the direction of the company and the corporate aviation aspect. And that was kind of what I hoped to solve with the airline.
We have this perception of I don't know who we is, at least us. And I think a lot of people have this perception of Southwest as being a great place to work. I mean, you know, we see, you know, happy employees all the time, or that's how it's portrayed. Maybe you can't answer this, but is that pretty accurate? Is that the way it really is at Southwest?
Yeah, you know, coming from corporate aviation, there's a few things that I notice when I see other pilots. Just an example, when I walk through an airport and I see another pilot, I don't care if they're, you know, what airline they work for or what company, because of my corporate background, it was always, what do you fly? Where are you coming from? How does that work? Can I go see your airplane? And that kind of thing. So now when I see another pilot at the airport, my first reaction is to say hi and to wave. But that other pilot always seems to look down at their shoes. I've never understood that. You know, as far as the airline perception is, I guess it's such a competitive market that you're looking at basically, I guess you would see the enemy, you know, when you're looking over at that other pilot. But I just don't have that mentality. So a little bit different.
Yeah, well, I think that's an attitude. That's a much more enjoyable way to go through life, I think, than to be in this constant competitive mode.
And I know with Southwest, I kind of strayed off your original question, but with Southwest, it always seems like it was in their blood to be the oddball, to be quirky. I think they encouraged that. You know, they were always trying to be. I remember stories that the original flight attendants that they hired were beauty queens, and they were cheerleaders and that kind of thing, where they were fairly outgoing, well-spoken, connect with your passengers, kind of, you know, that sort of thing. So
right.
I think when it comes to Southwest, that's really their goal, is to get people out there to not be afraid of doing something a little bit different, and just, you know, put yourself out there and do what you feel like is the right thing to do.
All right, great. Thanks for that perspective.
Hey, this is Keith Smith from PilotEdge.net, and when I'm not busy being an air traffic controller, I'm singularly obsessed with listening to Airplane Geeks.
All right, and now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 4, Episode number 27, September 30th through October 5th. The Airplane Geeks Airplane of the Week, the Blackburn B-1 Seagrave. Sir Henry Seagrave was born in Baltimore, Maryland. He had an American mother and an Irish father. He was raised in Ireland and attended Eton College. In 1914, he was commissioned into the Royal Flying Corps. He was seriously wounded twice in 1915 and again in 1916. Seagrave was obsessed with speed. While an administrator of the what became the RAF, he bragged to everyone he knew that he would be the first man to drive a car over 200 miles an hour. After the war, Seagrave became an auto racer. On March 29, 1927, Seagrave raced his car at Daytona Beach. He achieved a speed of 203 miles an hour, making him the first man to drive successfully a car over 200 miles an hour. Since he had the record on land, Seagrave turned to motorboating. He would be the only man ever to hold speed records for both land and sea at the same time. His successes would eventually earn him a knighthood. On Friday, July 13, 1930, Seagrave was testing his boat, Miss England II. Seagrave hit a log and the boat capsized. He would recover in a hospital for a brief moment and be told that he had broken the world speed record. He died a few minutes afterwards. Seagrave also tried his hand at designing a high-speed touring monoplane. The Sorrow Seagrave Meteor first flew on May 28, 1930. Production would be delayed by the death of Seagrave, which occurred only 15 days later. The Meteor was powered by two de Havilland Gypsy inline engines, developing 120 horsepower. It could cruise at 138 miles per hour and carry three passengers and a pilot. After Seagrave's death, the Meteor was shipped around Europe as the Seagrave Mark I. Piaggio Aircraft, the same air company that produces the Avanti, the official Airplane Geeks airplane, produced it under license as the Piaggio P-12. The Meteor and the P-12 were wooden airplanes with wooden monocoque fuselages and fabric skins. Blackburn would go on to produce three airframes with metal. They were the Seagrave 1, and two of which were built, and the Seagrave 2, most of which one was built. All three, with their 400-mile range, were used as shuttles across the English Channel. All six aircraft were completely out of service by 1938. So thus we had an aircraft designed by a boater who was born in the United States, flew for Great Britain, became a naturalized citizen, and then died by overturning his boat by a log. So next week we'll run the randomizer, and the winner will be... looks like we came up with another Brit. The Bristol 152 Beaufort. This is David M. Vanderhoof, the Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
All right. Thanks, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, October 1st. 2012.
Well, good day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 217. And I tell you what, Grant, I think I've just woken up from the most hideous nightmare.
Really? A hideous nightmare? Do tell, mate.
Well, you know, this week, Grant, was grand final weekend for the Australian Football League, and my team, the wonderful, awesome, mighty Hawthorn Hawks, I had this horrible dream that they lost, but that can't be true because they never lose anything. Go for it, mighty Hawks! Yay! Cue the music!
Oh, no, not the music.
We're a happy team at home.
Nah, mate, wait, hold the music. And I call that music in only the most extreme level. Sorry, it's not a nightmare, it's real. Your blessed Hawks didn't come across the line.
You mean it wasn't a nightmare, Grant?
No, it wasn't, mate. It was reality. The Hawks took a pounding.
Oh, no. Okay, well, I'm too depressed. That's it for the Australia Desk this week.
Hey, thanks to the AFL, we get to go off and have a party. I'm going to go crack a beer.
Well, I'm going to organise some therapy, Grant, but before that, let's do some aviation news then.
Okay, mate. All right, you're going to drag us back. Fine. On we go. How about major players on the Air New Zealand board are starting to leave?
Yes, that's right, Grant. As I wipe the tears from my eyes, according to this article in australianaviation.com.au, key executives depart Air New Zealand as the airline announces a share buyback. So it's all happening over there at Air New Zealand. Zealand.
That's right, mate. Rob Fyfe, who's been the man behind the haka behind the airline, he's already announced his departure back in June, and he'll be out as of the end of the year. And the new CEO, Christopher Luxon, is getting ready to take over the job from January.
Yes, Grant, and it looks like he'll the first order of business will be to fill a few vacant positions on the board as head of people and technical operations chief Vanessa Stoddart is leaving. Now, she's been there 10 years, according to this article, while Glenn Sary, general manager operations, is also leaving to take up another position, looks like, as a public servant.
Mate, not a bad role. But, yeah, look, it does happen. We saw the same thing happen in Virgin when Paul Getty came in. A lot of people decided that was it. They would either leave of their own accord, or he actually aided a few of them to find the exits, shall we say, as he went through and changed the tone of the board, is what they like to say, the tone of the senior executive team, taking out a few people and bringing in some new ones. It happens quite often when a CEO takes on a new role.
Now, these changes were announced ahead of Air New Zealand's annual general meeting, which took place just a couple of days later, and that was last week, in fact. And the airline also announced a share buyback. Through to September 2013, the airline will buy back 3% of its stock, which is listed on both the New Zealand and the Australian stock exchanges. Interesting stuff, mate.
Yeah, exactly. It's we'll see where this one goes. They've gone through a pretty hard period as passenger numbers have come down. They've cancelled a couple of routes, so we'll see what they manage to do. You never know with Air New Zealand. They generally have a bit of a can-do attitude.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, Ron, I wonder if they have a can-do attitude when it comes to repairing aircraft, because if it does, they could be talking to Airbus and Qantas. Looks like the wing crack problems that have been in the news for A380s for most of the year, looks like it's going to take Qantas a long time to repair all of their aircraft.
That's right, mate. Airbus have gone through and they've assessed it, and they finally know exactly how to solve the problem, and that's called take the aircraft out of the sky for 6 to 8 weeks and fix it. So not a quick fix by any stretch of the imagination, but Airbus is saying they should try and combine this fix with any other major checks while the aircraft is usually on the ground and kept from the air.
Yeah, that would only make sense if they did it that way. According to Flight Global, an 8-week time frame was the equivalent of up to 30,000 hours of labour. So, geez, you'd want to combine, you'd want to get as much maintenance in on those aircraft during that period.
That's a heck of a time to have an aircraft offline just to work through the wings. But there's a lot of joiners, a lot of fasteners, and a lot of issues to address. So, yeah, I guess it could take quite a while, but wow, that's going to be having a lot of airlines wanting to sit down and have a really special chat with Airbus, shall we say.
Yeah, I reckon. Well, I'll tell you what, those numbers might be big for Qantas, but some numbers that aren't quite as big as they'd hoped is their market share. Looks like they've fallen below 60%.
That's the one, mate. CAPA, the Centre for Aviation, has done some research on Qantas's current market share, and analysts from RBS are saying that based on those numbers, they put Qantas's share of the domestic market at only 58%, which is down from 63%, and that in turn is well below the group's 65% line in the sand that they drew some time ago.
Well, they might have to get the crayons out, Grant, and redraw that line.
Well, I think they're hoping that this the waves come in, wash it away, and they can go, oh, no, it was here, over here. No, see, 50%.
The same analysts here in this report say, Grant, that Virgin Australia's market share remains steady at 33%, while Tiger Airways has jumped from 4% to 9%. Now, that's very interesting, but I suppose that makes sense given that, as we reported in just a few weeks ago, they're starting to resume a larger chunk of their route network after their grounding last year.
They are, mate. They are increasing their capacity, more aircraft, more routes, but also an indication that, yes, people are willing to put up with almost anything to get a dirt cheap flight.
Do you reckon they'd put up with going to a different airport in Sydney, let's say at RAF Base Richmond, if they flew in there?
Well, there's a lot of people to the north of Sydney for whom flying into Richmond would be a lot more sense than flying into Sydney. It would be pretty well located for many of the northern and western suburbs. There's already a number of people who fly into Newcastle to try and avoid that whole problem of getting out of Sydney and up through to the north. So if you're not really in those northern beach areas and you're wanting to get into the inner northern suburbs and or western suburbs of Sydney, perhaps Richmond isn't too bad.
Now, this did come up as a news article either late last year, Grant, or early this year, if memory serves, and they are looking looking for other solutions to the hopelessly congested Sydney International Airport. It's just a basket case there, particularly with all the restrictions over number of movements and all this sort of stuff. And we've talked about that many times before. If they brought it into RAF Base Richmond, that would cost a lot of money to upgrade that base, not the least of which would be from a security standpoint. But the Civil Aviation and Safety Authority here looks like they're at least taking the idea partly seriously as they fund a study into the effects of introducing civilian operations into that Air Force base.
Mate, yeah, that was originally touted during some of the second airport in Sydney studies that have been going on all this year. And yeah, look, it does make a lot of sense in a way. Newcastle Airport already has some military operations going on there. Not uncommon to see wedge tails or MRTTs and definitely a few F-18s operating out of the area when you get to come in and land in your domestic jet. So precedent set there and in Darwin and other parts of Australia. So operating combined military and civilian isn't that impossible. And Richmond is very well placed for those in Penrith and Blacktown and those kind of areas, even perhaps Hornsby. It's possibly a little easier to get to than trying to struggle through the centre of town to get to Sydney. Whether the RAFIs and the domestic guys can actually sit down and figure this one out remains to be seen, but it does make a bit of sense compared to trying to struggle on with Sydney and or Newcastle. But meanwhile, they're still trying to figure out where they're going to build that second airport. The land that's currently reserved for it, the government's looking to sell that, and they're in turn looking for yet another spot, and they may actually be doing it closer to Picton down towards the southwest, where there's all sorts of houses being built. So it's kind of crazy, because if you go down there, you're going to have to take out a couple of big hills and fill in a bit of a valley and, by the way, get rid of a whole lot of new houses.
Well, I'll tell you what, Grant, I reckon if we're doing the Australia Desk report in about 25 years from now, I think we'll still be talking about a second airport for Sydney.
I don't know about a second airport for Sydney. I think we may actually be talking about how Sydney has lost the plot and is becoming a ghost town because everyone said enough and have gone to Bris Vegas in the north or Melbourne in the south.
Oh, well, no accounting for good taste. Well, Grant, speaking of RAF Base Richmond, that's also the home of 37 Squadron. The home of the RAF's fleet of C-130H Hercules aircraft. Well, not for much longer, though.
That's correct, mate. From the A to the E to the H to the J, the Aussies are moving on. We started with the A, and in fact, 36 Squadron was the first non-United States Air Force squadron to operate the C-130, and they then moved on through the E to the H, 36 and 37 Squadron operating them, and what wound up happening was that 36 Squadron has gone to the C-17, and they passed their H's on to 37 Squadron to run both H and J's, and we're phasing out the H's so that all that will be left will be the C-130J's. How is that for a lot of alphabet soup?
Boy, you've got me confused, mate, but I tell you what, a reunion's going to be held for past and present members of the C-130H community, and that'll be held up there at RAF Base Richmond, just outside of Sydney, on November the 24th. So anybody who is in this part of the world that might have had anything to do with the C-130H, that'll be a great event for you to get to. And Grant, there's actually a website that's been set up for it called hfarewell.com.
It's a pretty good site where you can see all the events going on, from a golfing morning and cricket afternoon on the 23rd to a mixed dining-in night on the 30th. So if you had anything to do with the H models in the RAF service, get on to H Farewell. That's H for hotel, farewell.com.
Well, that's interesting, Grant. And of course, RAF Base Richmond is just up there outside of Sydney. And there has been a lot of Sydney-based stories. I'm not sure I'm really comfortable with Sydney-based stories this week.
Yeah, that's right, mate. There's a lot of Sydney in here. And that's because the AFL Grand Final was won by the Sydney Swans. Now, much and all as I'm neutral and don't care about the game, I think it's only fair that we give a little bit of props and support to the Sydney Swans supporters and play their music, mate.
Cheer, cheer the red and the white.
Oh dear. Well, I suppose on the bright side, at least now it's cricket season. Somebody who knows all about that will be Peter Johnson, across the pond. I guess he's not playing cricket, but he's probably going to visit the Royal Navy Heritage Flight.
Cricket? Mate, that's death by statistics.
Recently, we were granted behind-the-scenes access to the Royal Navy Heritage Flight at their base at the Royal Naval Air Station in Yeovilton in the UK. We will hear four segments covering the team, the engineering and flying of one of the historic aircraft. We're grateful to the Royal Navy Heritage Flight for this opportunity to get behind the scenes, and particularly to Katie Campbell. They can be found at www.royalnavyhistoricflight.org. www.rockmark.uk. This mini-series will be played over the coming month or two. We hope you enjoy them and support the flight in whatever way you can. This first segment covers the background of the flight. I'm at Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton, and I'm with Katie Campbell, who's the display manager for the Royal Navy Historic Flight. Katie, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Thanks for taking the time out to spend with us. Can you tell us a little bit about the historic flight and what it's all about?
Okay, well, we're a Royal Naval unit based at Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton in Somerset in the UK. And our job is to act as a living memorial to all those that have served in the Fleet Air Arm and what was formerly the Royal Naval Air Service.
Right.
And we do that by flying aircraft to air shows. There's a museum here, the Fleet Air Arm Museum, that, if you like, is the National Archive and static display. But we're about servicing these aircraft and getting them out for everyone to see.
Right. And what aircraft do you actually have? Both here and in the collection.
Okay, our display aircraft consists of three Swordfish. For those of you who'd like to know, LS-326, W-5856 and NF-389. And then we have a Sea Fury VR-930 and a T-20 VX-281.
Right.
And a Seahawk WV-908. Those are our display aircraft.
Right.
And then in the background we have a Chipmunk that we use for pilot training and continuity training.
Yeah, and you're based here, and we've got the hangar with the aircraft in. Your job is to keep this show on the road.
I'm the sort of administrator, if you like,
behind
the scenes. So I'm tucked away in the background.
Right.
Display manager is the title of the job. So
yeah.
I'm booking the aircraft into various shows, and I always describe the job as I do everything the engineers don't want to do.
Right. Okay. I'm sure it's more
they
than that.
They don't like me describing it as that, but it's the admin behind the team, basically.
Okay. And the aircraft that we've got here fly predominantly in the summer.
They do. The show season runs from May through to October here in the UK.
Yeah.
And so we usually start flying in about March with check test flights, etc., work them up ready for the display season.
Yeah.
And then in October they come in and they'll go through their winter maintenance, because the maintenance is predominantly done through the winter.
Right.
And we're fair weather friends now. We don't
yeah.
take these aircraft out in anything other than very good conditions.
Okay. And what's involved in getting one of your aircraft or a group of your aircraft to one of these events around the UK?
It's quite simple. The organisers have a performer. They bid for them.
Yeah.
They bid to the Royal Navy, because, as I mentioned, we're a naval unit.
Yeah.
And the Royal Navy will decide which shows they want us to support,
yeah.
tell us about it. We then allocate the aircraft. And then it's just going through all the safety checks. Is it a
right.
show that we're happy to support? Sometimes it's an event that isn't an air show.
Yeah.
So we then have to put in all the various check all the airspace issues, put out
right.
what are known as NOTAMs. So we do everything. Whatever we check, we either going into an air show and just booking in.
Yeah.
And they've got the setup ready and we just click into that. Or we do all the paperwork around getting an aircraft
yeah.
to a specific event. And that's where my job comes in.
I knew it was a bit more than just a bit of admin. But when you've got the aircraft out and about, mm-hmm. they're here to, or they're at a show or at an event to promote.
They promote the Royal Navy. Obviously, as I say, they're primarily there as a memorial flight.
Yeah.
But obviously, they're flying the White Ensign for the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
And the naval ships can get to the harbours.
They're yeah.
They sort of sit outside of the UK. We can get inland
yeah.
and act as a sort of PR and marketing tool. It's a very nice word.
Yeah.
That's probably the only way I can think of it at the moment, for the Royal Navy.
Okay.
So we're out there flying the White Ensign and getting to millions of people every year.
And the Navy's very supportive of the historic flight, but it costs a lot of money to keep these fantastic aeroplanes operational. What are the challenges that you face having to keep the operation running?
Well, I mentioned we're a naval unit,
yeah.
but we're not fully mod funded.
Yeah.
So we have a certain amount of money and support
yeah.
just by being a naval unit. And we have a Royal Naval officer in charge of us, a commanding officer,
yeah.
Lieutenant Commander Sloan. But in effect, The engines, if they require overhauls, we have to find private money for that. We can't use taxpayers' money.
Okay.
And we have a charitable trust called the Fly Navy Heritage Trust that sit alongside us fundraising to make up for that deficit of funding.
Right.
So they're very much an integral part of the flight. We couldn't survive without their input.
Yeah.
And the fitters are all civilians. They're ex-service personnel, but they're employed.
Yeah.
And their salaries, the money also has to be found for that.
Right.
Now, that's a mix of naval money and money coming from this charitable trust.
Right, okay.
And they have quite a challenge looking for sponsors. They get a lot of support from industry.
Yeah.
But they also run events. One, to raise profile. Just by running the events, they're raising profile, but also hopefully bringing more money in.
Yeah.
And they run a supporters group as well.
Right, okay.
An FNHT supporters group.
And how can people get involved or support the historic flight?
Well, the best way is to Google FNHT.
Yeah.
And up will come the Fly Navy Heritage Trust website, which shows how you can support and help, because they coordinate that effort. We're very much here at the flight about just fixing and getting those aircraft out and the sort of generating that side of things.
Yeah.
But the support group, or the supporters group, and how you can help us is coordinated through the Fly Navy Heritage Trust.
Right, okay. And we've just had an interesting chat in the crew room with the mechanics. We've talked about various challenges and some of the history, some of my dad's stories. Mm. There's plenty more in the crew room. Feels like a really good team here.
It's great. It's a small unit. There are 10 of us, as I say, headed up by the naval officer, and then the 9 civilians. And it is a good team. It's great fun. I have great fun. Every day is different.
Yeah.
I never know what's going to happen.
Well, we're going to find out a little bit more over the coming weeks about the flight. We're going to run some interviews that we're about to record with the engineers and the pilots. So we look forward to seeing how the flight develops.
Mm.
And maybe we'll come back and see next year how some of the projects are going.
Absolutely. I've mentioned to you that we are hoping to rebuild a second Swordfish, W5856, and that will be done through this winter. So it'd be a delight if you'd come and see us do that and talk about it.
Katie, thank you very much for having us.
Pleasure.
They can be found at www.RoyalNavyHistoricFlight.org.uk. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right, thanks, Peter. I think that series coming up ought to be fairly interesting. Looking forward to that.
Yeah, it'll be cool because Peter has an attachment to the Swordfish, so
yes,
will come out over the next couple of weeks.
Yes, that'll be great. All right, let's move on to some listener mail. We have some from a number of listeners. First off, we have Michael. Michael writes, I am currently listening to your discussion of pre-9/11 airport security on episode 214 of the Airplane Geeks. I worked for an airport in aviation security at the time of the 9/11 attacks. I can tell you that at that time, the airlines were completely responsible for passenger screening. Airports had no responsibility for this aspect of security. My experience is that prior to 9/11, airlines viewed security as a zero return expense and an inconvenience for their passengers. You can draw your own conclusions. So thanks to Michael for those comments. Yeah, we were talking about, I don't know if we kind of nailed it, but I think we were speculating that prior to 9/11 that the airlines had security responsibility, and we were talking about that in the context of a lawsuit out there against some of the airlines that were involved in the 9/11 attacks. So thanks to Michael for that. We also heard from Chris, who is actually ATC Ben's co-worker in Melbourne, Australia. He says, hi guys, still love the podcast and still listen as often as I can. In the info at the beginning of the show notes of episode 214 on the web, you mentioned the B-17R stagger wing, but there is no mention of it in the podcast. Is this just a nice picture for the web, or did you leave it out, or am I missing some podcast? So the answer, Chris is asking about the photo we use for the the blog post on airplanegeeks.com. And we actually, we get photos from a number of different sources. Our goal is to make sure that we're not infringing on any copyright, so we're very careful about where we get pictures from. We don't just lift them off the internet. So we either get things that are public domain or that we have permission from the copyright holder to use, and that's kind of how we view it. Now,
have I given you permission to use my photographs? I don't think so.
By default, that's when you signed your co-host contract, David. You agreed to waive all copyright issues. No, but yeah, we've had some photos from David, from some listeners. We try to make them somehow associated with some content on the podcast, but it doesn't always work out that way. And the last episode, that episode 214, was an example of that, where it didn't really have anything that went along with anything we talked about in the episode. But Stephen Tornblum, our listener from the West Coast, from California, who often sends us photos, very nice ones, had recently sent us a little collection that he had taken. And that included that stagger wing. And I remember, David, didn't you mention the stagger wing once? Didn't we talk about that once a long time ago?
Actually, it was an airplane of the week.
Yeah.
One of my all-time favorite airplanes. So.
Yeah. So Stephen had this photo of it. So that's how it came to be on the post. So, I mean, I can go farther and say that if you are a, you know, fairly decent aviation photographer and have some interesting shots that, you know, you'd like to send along and give us permission to use, then you may find them on the Airplane Geeks posts for the episode. So you know, we're always looking for great photos. In fact, the one I think I'm going to use for this episode is another of Stephen's photos that he took at JFK, and he's got some really nice night shots of some airliners, and I think I might use one of those.
Oh, and Max, they could always also post them to a Facebook.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. If you have some interesting photographs you've taken, just post them to our Facebook page and let all the listeners have an opportunity to see them. That's a great suggestion, David. Thanks.
You can use any of the photos I send in.
Okay, so we have perpetual right for all. Okay, great. We got an email from Diego. This is Diego from Aero Podcast in Spain. Which is a great Spanish language podcast. He says that he'd like to share something that happened to him personally in the beginning of September. Now, this was in the news. This was a flight from Zurich to Beijing with Swiss. He says after 4 hours of flight, when we were over Moscow, the captain gave us a first message asking for a doctor or a nurse. And then 15 minutes later, a new message telling us that we were going back to Zurich due to a fight that took place in the back of the plane. And then he's got a link to an article in the press describing this. He says the fight was between two Chinese passengers that were completely drunk, and the inconvenience for the passengers and the cost for the airline for the consequences of their behavior was tremendous. The point I would like to discuss is that if the industry has been strong enough to forbid smoking on board, why can't we push also to prohibit serving alcoholic drinks on board? I understand that if a passenger wants to drink alcohol on board, he or she can buy it at the airport, but maybe we should think about why we give so much easy access to alcohol on the plane. We've all seen people drinking a lot on the intercontinental flights, and most of the time I assume it helps to give them a nap on the plane, but how would you react if the beverages on board were all alcohol-free? Just waiting to hear your comments. You know, interesting. I mean, I've definitely encountered, sort of a celebrity that had a little bit too much to drink and thought his celebrity status, permitted him to kind of do whatever he wanted to do. And this was quite a while ago. I think these days, like with Diego, if that had happened, the plane would have returned to drop the passenger off. So, John, have you had any experience with any unruly passengers that you had to take sort of extraordinary action with?
Yeah, the only thing, in my year and a half with the airline, which is a very short time, I had a husband and wife that were in a domestic dispute. And I think the first thing that you find out in a domestic dispute, when you go to break up that domestic dispute, you not only get the guy, I guess, that you're trying to subdue, but you also get his wife jumping on you at the same time. So you have to be careful about
two for one, yeah,
what you're doing there. And we had one on our way, strangely enough, to Philadelphia. I'm sorry, David, but we were
naturally where else?
No, yeah. Never failed. Never failed.
We were on our way to Philadelphia. We had a husband and wife in an altercation in the back of the airplane, and I think with just moving them to different places on the airplane and basically threatening them with jail time, that was the last that we ever heard of it up in the cockpit. So it was all taken care of.
Well, I think in this case that Diego encountered, I mean, it was similar to your husband and wife, although I mean, I think these guys weren't related, but when some of the cabin crew tried to break up the fight, they both ended up attacking the flight attendant. So it was a pretty ugly situation.
It never fails, yeah. And when you talk about taking alcohol off of airplanes, it seems like there's such a long history there. I know with my airline, within their inner Texas battles that they had Dallas to Houston flights, the fares, if I remember right, they were like $10 each. And the fight was so hard to get Southwest to basically go bankrupt that Southwest had to come up with a different marketing strategy. And they basically said, if you buy this $10 ticket, we will give you, I think they were given a fifth of whiskey out. And that that basically got all the business travelers to buy tickets because the whiskey was thrown in kind of under the table. No one ever had to report what the purchase was. The business travelers got to take it home. And it seems like alcohol and airlines have been tied so closely together. And maybe that's just business travel itself. But it's going to be hard to get that off the airplane.
Yeah, I think so. All right, let's go on to the next email. This is from Yuri. He says, I love the show, having listened to it consecutively since I first heard of it. Two questions. First, a YouTube link that he attached is that of the, remember the FedEx MD-11 crash in Narita, a very spectacular crash. He says, is there any particular reason that MDs are considered bad for landing? Unstable, perhaps, when they touch ground? Maybe Rob or David can answer that one. So I'm not aware of any, I don't know, particular MD or MD-11 issues.
I don't know of any myself, Max. When I think about, you know, unstabilized aircraft, it seemed to me from the video, just watching the video, that maybe there was something that if there was a gust of wind or the aircraft got slow, the CG was maybe at an extreme, any of those small factors may throw in to destabilize the airplane. And right at the last, maybe in the flare or the last part of the landing, it seemed like the aircraft had a bad bounce and then all of a sudden it ended up on its nose.
It was that accident that made me realize the power of Twitter, because it just so happened that, you know, I had I had Twitter open and was watching the tweets go by, and there was a pilot in another plane at Narita sitting in his cockpit basically watching this unfold and tweeting, you know, real time as this accident happened. Sort of showed me the power of something like Twitter. Yuri also has a second question. He was asking if there's any chance that we could get a physician and pilot to talk about how he manages life as a doctor and a pilot. So I don't know if we have any listeners that either are or know of some interesting pilot/doctors or surgeons. Maybe we get connected.
We got to get a naval flight surgeon or an Air Force flight surgeon.
That would be good. Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. If for no other reason than David's Skype is dying on him and we're having trouble hearing David. So with that, we'll say we want to thank everyone for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Want to thank especially our guest, Nigel Howarth from Aviation Week, and especially because he came on with just absolute short notice, very short notice, and we really appreciate that. He does fleet databases and MRO forecasting. And we also want to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. I hear in their latest episode that they've got a new member of the team over there, Ben, not ATC Ben, but sounds like a very interesting guy. I think he's going to add a lot to that program. And we also want to thank Peter Johnson. You can find him at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. And also his podcast with Tim and Gareth, which you can find at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. We'll start with David and hope the Skype is working.
No such luck.
No such luck.
I was actually putting it on call recorder so I would get it for you.
Okay.
You can find my blog at whatjustflewby.com. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. And you can find me on Google Plus as David Vanderhoof. And don't forget to check our Facebook page, which is Facebook.com/AirplaneGeeks. And Airplane Geeks on Google Plus.
All right, excellent. And John Arvin, thank you for joining us. It's been kind of a real delight to have a listener come on the show as sort of a guest co-host. And we really enjoyed having you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's been real enjoyable. Hope to do it again sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to have you. Now, do you have anything online that you'd like to share with our listeners, a webpage or Twitter or anything like that?
Yeah, I have a webpage that's theaviationadvocate.com and also on Twitter at theavavadvocate. And I'll try and get a few videos on corporate aviation up on the webpage. And I'll see if I can post some of my photos. Also, really enjoy taking a lot of photos as I fly, so I'll try and get more of those posted for you guys.
Great. Love to see those. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter and Google Plus as Max Flight. Also, check out my aviation directory at 30,000feet.com. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 217. There you'll find links to all the sites we mentioned on the podcast. And be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus, as David mentioned. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us right to your mobile phone. If you'd like to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Aunt Benet's got that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. All right, join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Bye, everybody. The Airplane Geeks podcast is sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn-to-fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight.
Oh, yeah, there is a question, Max.
Fire away.
Kind of a question. Richard thinks that's your real name, and I find that hard to believe. But you know, I don't want to insult you or anything, but...
No, it's no insult.
You know the really cool thing about having this fancy DVX compressor limiter gate, Grant?
No, what's the really cool thing about having this fancy DVX compressor limiter gate, Steve?
Every time you and I talk, there's so many blinking lights everywhere. It's fantastic. It's quite distracting, actually. In fact, what are we talking about again?
I don't know. I'm starting to get tuned into this whole thing of the lights that are blinking and flashing and the system's beeping and buzzing. So everything's blinking and flashing and beeping and buzzing. Sorry, I got carried away there.
Okay, Grant, know what this sound is?
No.
It's the sound of me putting away instruction manuals, which I never read.
Dun, dun, dun. You dipshit.
On the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Can I do it like Rob does when he does it?
Yeah, okay. So I'll set it up again. Join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Come on, John, I'm waiting for you.
Oh, I thought you were going first, David.
Thanks for listening.
Bye, everybody.
All right. That's a good Rob Mark invitation. So what'd you think, John? Was that anything like you expected?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I hope you can make me sound somewhat knowledgeable as you put it together.